One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi lads, thanks for tuning into the podcast again. Don't forget to like and subscribe and head over to the Patreon to contribute and help us out. Thanks a million and enjoy the podcast. Hello everybody and welcome back to the Tone Irish podcast. As always, I'm joined by my good friend Timmy Long.
Hi everyone.
Rowan is on the decks. Hi Rowan.
Hello.
I'm James Leonard and this week we have a Limerick man, our first Limerick guest, Joe Slattery. How are you, Joe?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for helping me.
Thanks for coming down on a beautiful Sunday morning.
Yeah, no worries. I'm honored to be your first Limerick man.
Yeah, yeah, no better book either. Yeah. My first interaction with you, Joe, was a few months ago on LinkedIn. You contacted me and you said, hi James, I seen you on the Tommy Tiernan show. I'm actually on the Tommy Tiernan show in a few months, if you have any advice. Yeah. So that's kind of how we got connected.
It is.
Will you tell us a little bit about how you ended up on the Tommy Tiernan show? Or maybe go back to the start, actually.
Yeah.
Who you are, where you're from, for the people that don't know you.
Yeah, so as I said, my name is Joe Slattery and I'm from Limerick City, and originally from South Hill in Limerick City. And I suppose how I ended up on the Tommy Tiernan show was a bit of a whirlwind. So because of the job, the equine therapy that I do, I ended up doing a TED Talk in the Tivoli Theatre in 2018. And that got a lot of coverage. And then the Dublin Horse Show saw my TED Talk and they asked me to be a guest speaker in the Dublin Horse Show in 2019. So I'd done 3 days as a guest for them, speaking around the positives of equine therapy. And as part of the promotion for the Dublin Horse Show, I ended up on the Marion Finucane show and I'd done a real intense interview with her, speaking about my life, speaking about my upbringing, speaking about my family and all the issues and all that was around that. And that went viral, that blew it away, you know, and that's how I ended up in the Tommy Tiernan show. But it was the ripple effect from the TED Talk, ended up on the Dublin Horse Show, ended up the Marion Finucane show. And
do you know the Marion Finucane, the TED Talk, the Tommy Tiernan? Pretend now that you never did any of them.
Yeah.
And this is, people are hearing about you for the first time because a lot of our followers may have never heard you, or you know, they might have a passing knowledge. But we're from South Hill. Do you want to tell us a little about what it was like growing up? And
yeah. So, I mean, obviously, at the time growing up there, you were just living your life and you knew no better. And South Hill was my world. You know, it's a very small bubble. But at the time of growing up there, I was born in 77, so the 80s and 90s were my kind of growing up there. And where we lived even, it was quite unique because where South Hill is, it's actually on the edge of County Limerick. So if I come out my front door, I was looking at fields. But actually what I was looking at was a big stone quarry, right? Literally, you come out your front door, your council house garden, a footpath, and then you drop into a stone quarry. But past that, then was all fields. But then if you go out the back door, you're in the heart of South Hill and then you're in the heart of Limerick City.
It's like Knocknaheeny in Holly Hill, where we're from. Where we're from, you're right next to the city centre. I walked there 5-10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then out the back door, you're fields, and then you've Blarney, you know. I bring my dogs up to walk. There's a water tower up in Knocknaheeny. That's kind of our logo. It's like a reservoir, you know.
Up
around that, you've beautiful fields, you know. But then 5 minutes down the road, you've the city centre, you know. Yeah. So it's kind of like that.
Yeah, so it was quite unique. Now, the one thing, even at that time, when I look back now, it really bothers me and angers me because they turned that quarry into a city dump. They filled it up. Now, literally, my front door, at the most, was 20 or 30 feet away from the city dump. And there was a row of houses, maybe 12 houses, and they angled off as you went down. But our house, out the front doorstep, and you're in the city dump. So that's what we grew up in, fucking city dump, right? So, and at the time, it was the best playground in the world. You're on there, you're hunting rats. Mm-hmm. You're having all these fights with rotten potatoes. And I remember one time someone dropped in big jars of Nutella. You were all eating it, like, you know. So it was fantastic, right? But when I look back in, but when you grow up in that kind of environment, it also sets the tone of what you're worth. You know what I mean? You're worth living on a dump, right? And also then you're listening to the adults at the time who grew up in South Hill, and you'd overhear them saying, the people who are your peers that you're looking to try and model your behaviour off, and they're like, oh, geez, you wouldn't put South Hill in the dress now. You'd never get a job if people know you're from South Hill. Mm. So you're hearing all this stuff about yourself that you're no good, right? And then that's the external, and then internal within the family home. Like, both my parents came from regeneration areas as well, different areas of Limerick, right? And they had a horrific car crash in their early 20s. So in probably 22, 23, my father lost both of his legs. My mother was nearly killed. She went through the window of the car. So, and there was three kids at this stage. So myself, my older brother, only 11 months between us, and my younger sister. And I was probably four at the time. I'm not really sure. It's kind of vague, you know. I don't have all the details. So we were all separated. And of course, no one told you. I was fully aware that my parents were gone, but no one told you where they were gone and what was happening. Next year, we were all separated. So we were all thrown into different families, you know, different relatives, and no one told you what was happening. But I was actually with my relative in the block where we lived. So I used to be able to go down to the house, and I'd go down outside the back door, and I'd be like,
what's the story?
Everyone's gone, like, you know. So that, well, I suppose, and the funny thing is, I've no impact on memories of my life before that happening. So obviously, you know, I was three or four, so my father had legs, and there was memories of that stuff. I've no memories of it. I don't remember any of that, right? So obviously, they came back. But now, when I look at it as an adult, they never came home. They died that night. Yeah. Different people come home. So my father, mentally, emotionally, physically, subconsciously, never came back. A different man came back, you know. And then you had and like I said, they're in their early 20s. So now they'd be considered adolescents. They wouldn't be considered adults yet, like, you know, with three kids. So you had my mother, who was dealing with all her own injuries, then had three kids to mind, and also a man in the background that was broken, for the lack of a better word, you know, full of anger, you know, probably full of self-despair, probably full of his own insecurities because he wasn't the man he used to be. You know, so I can imagine now if I was him and this happened to me, God, will my wife leave me now? Will she think I'm someone else? And then internally, you're going to feel like you're someone else. So as you can imagine, he was having internal battles for a very, very long time in himself. My mother then, like I said, she was a career cleaner her entire life. Three kids in the house. So the house was swimming against the tide. So your mother was a ball of anxiety, trying to keep everyone happy. Your father in the background that was full of anger and rage whenever he was going on. So then you had the three kids. So that impacted me in a very negative way because we were in survival mode for a very, very long time.
Isn't it just so tragic, you know, that a young family, you know, can be just kind of fundamentally changed overnight from a crash, you know?
It just sounds
very sad. I could picture, you know, in your early 20s, for a man, in your early 20s, having a wife and kids, and for your legs to be taken off, you know, like, exactly the damage that does to you.
Yeah.
That's sad, like.
Yeah, and it took him many years to get over. Now, he sadly passed away since, but he's an interesting character because everyone admired him because he was a great man, right? And he was a great man. I mean, he never had self-pity, and even when he died, he was working and he had a car, and we used to sell coal and blocks as kids. So, and he'd come out with us with the no legs, right? And he'd haul onto the back of the cart and we'd go around door to door selling the blocks. But he'd be out in the back on the weekends chopping the blocks and bagging the grass. The man was a machine, right?
Yeah.
So everyone saw that he's a great man. He was. But he wasn't a great father. He was closed off. He couldn't show emotion. He was stone cold, like, you know?
Yeah.
And then because I suppose the way I responded in, I reacted out, whereas my brother went inwards and went quiet, and I done stupid shit and I got in trouble and I got things. So I'd go head to head with him then. So there'd be war in the house and he'd fucking bait shit on me, like, you know. So then I had that side. So I never liked the man, you know, because we were always clashing heads. So he was never someone that I'd go as a father figure to get advice from. And so that I had no one then I would go to for those kind of moments of needing security and needing comfort.
How was your mother? Is it like she's carrying some burden there?
Yeah, my mother is an old school Irish mother, puts the head down and marches forward no matter what life throws at him.
Never looks after her own needs.
No, never. And now she's in her 60s, and you can see the residual effects of that on her. Like, you know, she's still working as a scrap cleaner, and she won't stop because that's her life. That's what she does, you know. But she is, she's just a machine, you know, and she just goes on. And we had, like, even though we had nothing for a long time, we had the best of nothing. We were always spotless clean. The house was always spotless clean. Our clothes were always clean. And, you know, we wouldn't be going around with holes in our jumpers. So that was kind of the background. But the one thing they both done that kind of stood to us forever to this day is the grafting. We had to work. So I worked from a very young age because we all did. So that was the way it was done. Like my father and like my mother would tell us, like she'd go to my father, there's no money in the house, we have no money. He'd get the ladder and bucket and he'd go start cleaning windows in the neighbourhood. So there was never embarrassment about making hard money, and you just made it and you went and grafted. And that's how he done it. He didn't do it by scamming and stealing, he'd done it by grafting, you know. So he made us graft as well from a young age. So from a very young age, I had a donkey. And then it turned into a donkey and cart, right? And then it turned into, okay, we'll get blocks and briquettes and you're going to sell loads in the donkey and cart. And I don't know what age I was on, but I was young enough that we couldn't lift coal yet. We weren't strong enough. But when we got strong to lift coal, then we had the carts and the four-wheeler. We'd go and do that. And in the summertime, then we'd go and cut grass, you know? And I used to hate it because I wanted to hang around with the lads, because all my spare time was hanging around with the lads on the corner and I'd be drinking and getting high and whatever. And he, now I know what he was doing was saving me from all that trouble. He was making me work to distract me from having too much time, because I guarantee you if I had too much time in my hands, I would end up in jail. Absolutely. I got arrested a few times for stupid stuff.
You know, in South Hill, would South Hill be an area where they would be overrepresented in the prison system? Would there be high levels of poverty and stuff like this?
South Hill was one of the most disadvantaged areas in Europe for a while, and it also had the highest murder rate.
Yeah.
Right? South Hill was, I think it was about 500 houses, and I'd say the vast majority of them were unemployed, and a lot of them would have been single mothers and generations of families of unemployment and early school age and poverty, and they were all plucked in together. So there was no, it's very hard to aspirations to set the bar higher because everyone was on the same bar. Of what they thought life was like. There was a hell of a lot of trauma. And I found that difficult because I'm actually quite a soft person, quite emotional. And I like being this way, but at the time, I didn't want to share that with, right? So that's where, and you know, I had no self-esteem. I had no confidence. I was told I was going to end up in prison if I didn't stop. I was told I was stupid. I was fucking idiot. You know, so I heard all those thoughts. And of course, I believed them. So I had no faith in myself. So I just hung around the street with the lads as much as I could. I didn't want to be in the family home because I didn't like the atmosphere in the house. Didn't like being around my father. So I spent my time out in the streets. And out in the streets then was a risky place to be, because at any given time, you could find yourself in a situation that didn't need to happen, but just would happen. And I was speaking earlier on to Timmy about this. I think there's so many people that are going around with undiagnosed PTSD. And South Hill, because it was a small area and because there was so much aggression up there and because there was so much tension in the atmosphere, everyone was going around ready to explode. So you couldn't have a disagreement with someone and verbally figure it out. You know, it just went straight into attack mode. And, you know, people had knives and people had guns, you know. And as it went on in the 80s to the 90s, when drugs became more prevalent, so did obviously the guns coming in with them. And so did the gang-related families in that small area. So you had feuds going up there and people were drive-by shooting, like, you know. I remember one time outside my front garden with my brother and my two nieces kicking ball. Loads of lads run past the Ballyclava, shot up the house down the road. And we were tentatively related to them. And when they were running past, one of them stopped. And he just stared at me for a second. And that second was 2 hours. You know, just because he was contemplating whether to take off shot or not, and then he ran off again.
I think the big difference between Cork and Dublin and Limerick. In Cork in the 80s and 90s, we had a kind of organised crime here as well, you know. But it was after the 90s, really. There's never been really organised crime. You'd have kind of freelance, maybe small gangs. But there was never that kind of culture of shootings. Now you'd have murders in Cork too, but they're isolated, you know, but never had the feud and kind of element, the organised crime in Dublin and Limerick around that time as well. We never really had that in Cork, to me, we didn't.
It never got to that kind of level, really. It was just kind of small little groups of gangs, not even gangs really, of lads just selling drugs, and you know, there was never any massive feud, you know, within the city, or real kind of gun crime within the city. It was all small enough, but you'd always see national news then with Limerick in it, or Dublin. And now, at the moment, there's other counties being brought into that kind of bracket as well.
Limerick, I mean, publicity, national publicity, it gets a bit of a raw deal anyway, but it always does because that sells, like, you know. And but even before those big feuds that made the headlines, you know, there was always little stuff going on in the communities anyway, like those little tough wars, but people got killed on them, like, you know. And sadly, there was a lot of people that weren't involved in gang in any way, but they'd get into a fight with another person, and sadly, one of them would die. And then there's two lives ruined. You know, the person was dead, and obviously the person killed them. And it's so difficult because they're both, all the families, I remember within 1 year there was probably 10 murders, but they were murdered by 10 people that lived in there. So you had two families living in one community affected by this. You had a whole community affected by it. And then you're kind of caught in on whose sides you take here. Who do you say hello to? Who do you ignore? You know, and all this went on because you get dragged in then if you make the wrong decision, you know? And this is all the stuff you're thinking about as you're going around your day to day, like, you know?
Is there a high sense of anxiety around Limerick at that time?
Absolutely. Yeah, massive, absolutely. Yeah. And I was only saying it, like, I can still see it now in Limerick. I can see it. Like, I'm watching now because I know what to look for. And lads going around there and they're light on their feet and they're constantly looking around. And the thing, when you're looking at them, they look shady, like, you know, that they're up to something, but they're not. They're actually just scanning around, like, you know. Yeah. And Limerick has changed over the years, and there is a fantastic approach gone into tourism and making it a city of culture and a city of sport and taking away from that Stab City. It's no longer Stab City. That's gone. It's a beautiful city. But there is still those generations, because you have the four generation areas around the city, you know, so it's on the outskirts coming in. So that hasn't changed. Like, they're still there, you know. Now there's a lot of services been pumped into them, and the regeneration service itself has spent millions on services within the areas to make those lives better. And they've been very effective in getting people to see their worth, see their self-belief, and change their perspective, but also change their parenting. So what they're doing is changing the parent from the next generation. So the parenting that I got from a kid, I'm not going to do that to my kid. My kid is going to have a better upbringing, which means I've now changed that cycle of damage, you know. So they do a lot of work around that, but it's further thinking, you know. It's not about just fixing one thing, it's actually fixing the whole generation of problems.
And it's also about, like, it's also about not bringing up the past and passing the past on to your own kids.
Yeah.
Because that past, like, when I say the past, I'm on about this stuff that went on in the early noughties, like in the late 90s up in Limerick, you know. Like, that's the past.
Yeah.
You know, but when you pass that on to the next generations of kids, like, it can be passed on. Because I remember when all the gangland stuff was going on in Limerick, and it was actually mental. People from other counties were actually afraid to go to Limerick for weekends and stuff.
And
that was the reality, and people were just bypassing Limerick because they were actually in fear because of what was going on at the time, you know. But, like, I've said this to you before, we were having a chat. Like, I was in the Midlands prison, and there's a lot of lads from Limerick in the Midlands prison. And I got on with every single one of them, you know, because they seen me just keep my head down and do my own thing. And I got on with them, and, you know, I could see, when I look back in hindsight, no, they were just really, really trying to figure themselves out as well. A lot of the older guys, like, were just, like, they had a bit of a rep as well, but they were also trying to control the younger fellas that were coming in, and they wanted to, you know, they wanted to be a part of something as well. And, you know, they had their own stuff going on as well. But I got on with them really well, you know, because I could see that they were just really doing their best. And a lot of them probably will never get out of prison, you know, or they'll struggle to get out of prison at some
stage.
We're
all very similar, and we're all just human with emotions. And some of us have harder stories than others, and some of us are better able to cope with those than others, you know. But when it comes down to it, we're just people who are trying to cope the best that we can. And sometimes the decisions we make send us down a wrong road, as in end up in prison, right? And then you're in there. And then you're like, okay, do you know what? It's actually probably okay inside here at the moment. Better off in here than I was outside, you know? But you also have time then to maybe think. You know, I don't know. I haven't been in prison, right? So, you know, I can't speak from an area of expertise. But I know a lot of lads who have. And actually, it wasn't that bad. And it was probably safer and quieter. And the brain got to slow down in there than it did in their communities.
I can definitely testify that that's the truth for me as well. Prison was like a almost respite for me, do you know what I mean? Because the streets can be very harsh, do you know? And especially when you're in addiction, there's no easy day, do you know what I mean? You're either looking for money to get drugs or sick or, you know, withdrawing most of the time, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Very, very small percentage of the time I actually high, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Most of the time is consumed with ways and means of trying to get money to use, you know?
Do you know, when I felt my safest ever, in my life, being locked behind that door for 18 hours a day, knowing that there's these big retaining concrete walls and bars on the window and a big massive steel door in front of me. And I knew that I'd be safe within the confines of that. And I don't know how how it may sound, you know, to other people, but when I look back, I never felt so safe in my whole life because I was away from my natural environment and I was here, and when that door was locked, it was like, yeah, I felt safe.
You're safe and nothing can get into you and nothing can get out.
And when you think about the Limerick lads that you were talking about, they're walking around, you know, looking around like, you know, chicken heads, hyper-vigilant. But when you're in there, there's all the walls around you, the door, you can kind of, you know, I'm actually fine here now, you know.
But that's the PTSD, I think, you know, and you're hyper-vigilant when there's a fear of threat and there's a fear that you're going to die, you know. But like I said, if those doors are locked solid around you, then no one can get in, then you can calm down, you know. But there is... It's a.
But that was a very tough time in Limerick City's history. And just when you said the term Stab City there, I hadn't heard that term for years until Forbes article.
That brought it back up again. That got some reaction. That was a bad move. I don't know what
there
that
was
thinking.
For people that don't know, right, there's two Limerick brothers. They're into the tech. Ron, you might have heard of them. They're billionaires now.
They set
up a Stripe. It's like a
PayPal kind of
PayPal. It's like a PayPal service, you know. So if you're buying something online, you'll use Stripe as like the middleman between you and the person you're buying from, you know. They manage to pay. They're two young brothers in their maybe 30, early 30s.
Yeah, I don't even know.
They're billionaires anyway, right? And Forbes had an article, American, you know, media, business media, had an article, and it was like, from Stab City to billionaire, you know, and there was some backlash online, because it was sensationalist. It was like...
that the heading then?
There was so much, it was so much backlash on the internet that they actually took down the whole article. Yeah. First, they changed the title, and then they just got rid of the whole article. But, you know, it was like, we've moved on from that, you know what I mean? It was a long time ago.
It has, the city has vastly improved and vastly changed, and the whole... atmosphere and reputation of the city is gone from that kind of way to where it is now, like, you know.
If we go back to your story,
so
you were on about you didn't like being in the family home because of the atmosphere. Were you experimenting with alcohol and drugs on the streets, or
from a very young age? I mean, my mother tells me a story. Now, of my grandfather, I don't remember him. I remember fearing the man, right? I don't remember any visual representation, but I remember the fear of fearing him. And my mother saying, oh, it's because I was smoking fags. And she said, oh, we'll sort him out. And the grandfather old school, I'll make him a roll up and give it him. So I smoked on it and it done nothing, you know. But I can't even remember that man. Mm-hmm. So this was from a very young age. I was doing stuff that was causing damage, right? But yeah, so what I would do is start to drinking the old cans of Carling, the cans of Foster's, me and one of my mates. And we used to play under 12 football. And I remember the manager, he passed since. He said, I've never had two fellas turn up for drunk at your age before. Like, you know, the two of us were like, got out that match. And we only had two cans of Carling each, but we were kids, you know. But yeah, so that was it. And then obviously hash came in. So I remember my first time smoking hash. I can still remember. I can clearly tell you everything that we'd done, like, you know. So we started smoking hash, and then when the weed came in, and it was a daily thing, and we'd set the joints up for the night before for the next morning. So I was sedated morning, noon and night, you know. There was a time there where I was gone from the family home. I just had an argument. So I'm out here, and went over to live one of my friend's house. And at the time, there was another friend living there, and his father had been murdered by someone local, right? And so, and then I'm hanging out, and it was only a field away, you know, as in the house instead of away. And I was sleeping in this house with my mate, and the other lad was living there, sleeping there as well, and I was sleeping in this bunk bed, but it went across the top window. So my bed was over the top window of the house. And I laid there at night, in the feet position, because just waiting for that window to be shot in, because these were serious people that were up in court that murdered his father, and obviously witnesses and all this stuff, so the intimidation was going on. And I remember just having to lie there in the feet position, terrified. I could stone as much as I could, because I was thinking, if I get shot, I won't feel it. Even though I had nothing to do with it, I still felt I was dragged into, you know. So stuff like that happened all the time, where you just find yourself being dragged into shit, and you wanted nothing to do with it, you know. So that's what I done. I got stoned. I got stoned a lot, and I got drunk a lot, and, you know, take cocaine and different things like that, you know. Whatever was available, I would just take it, like, you know, without much questions, because I didn't really care, because I had no value in myself. I had no self-esteem, so it didn't matter what I was taking. I just will take off. But the one thing I'd done, which I had no choice of, I still had to go to work, right? So I could be, and we'd sell coal and blocks, and it would be in the evening time, right? Because what we do is after school, we come home, have our dinner, change your clothes, and then you'll sell coal and blocks. But then on the holidays, you'd want to keep the same time as when you go around to people's houses, so they know you're coming. So sometimes we wouldn't be at school, so I'd have all day up to 4 o'clock, and I'd be down the field drinking 2 litres of cider with my mate in the field, and then I'll be sniffing petrol or doing what I'd be doing, and then I'm going out selling corn black and leaves. I'd still have to work, you know. Yeah. And I never lost that. It was probably the best thing that ever stood to me, is that grafting, like, you know. And I think this a lot. Why didn't I end up in addiction? Why did I not get that far in, like some of my friends had, and some of them are dead, and some of them are now in their 40s and they're still using, like, smoking weed and drinking every night. And I think it was because of the work. I think it's because I had to go to work, so I had something to do, you know. So I never got addicted, but what I was drug reliant. And I relied on drugs to not have to deal with my emotions, because I didn't know what to deal with them. And I remember being in therapy, and I was talking to the psychotherapist, and I was talking about smoking weed and copious amounts of weed, and she said, sounds like you were lucky you had it. And it was the first time I looked at it like that, and I was like, yeah, it is. That and the horses.
Yeah, we spoke about that here many times. You know, we're lucky we had drugs at the time because it stops you from committing suicide. It stops it numbs you from the harsh reality that you're living in. Yeah. Or in lieu of any other coping skills, it is a coping skill, you know what I mean? It's better than having no coping skills.
Yeah,
you know?
There's many people alive today because of drugs. You know, I said that in a conference one day, and I dropped them out like that, you know. And they didn't get it. And then I had to try and explain to them. And then I was doing an interview with someone around resiliency. Now, it was someone for their masters, and they wanted to interview me.
Yeah.
And they were talking about resiliency. And then I started talking about homeless people and people, drug users, as resiliency. And really good resiliency to be able to live day to day in that environment, because it would break many a person. But they never looked at it that way. You always see them as vulnerable people, which they are, right?
Yeah.
But they're also really mentally strong in other ways to be able to live in that environment and still be here with all the trauma that they went through, and they found a way of living, and they found a way to live in tents and still live and be able to get your substances, you know what I mean? Yeah. So these are really, really resilient people.
There's a great book on something what you're talking about there. It's Viktor Frankl.
Yeah.
Do you ever hear of Viktor Frankl? He's a psychiatrist. He was in a concentration camp.
Okay.
He was a psychiatrist when he got put into the concentration camp.
Yeah.
But he wrote about his experiences while he was in there in secret. But he wrote a very, very famous book. It's called Man's Search for Meaning. And it's about, even though when you're in the depths of it, no, there's nothing worse than Auschwitz. We can agree on that.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's parallels to be drawn with homelessness and addiction, you know, because it's a miserable, miserable, harsh existence that people would say, oh, if I was in Auschwitz or if I was in homeless, I wouldn't be able. But when you're in that situation, you will be able, because we're very resilient, and you find meaning in that hell that you're living. You'll find the meaning, and if for people that have been through a lot of traumas and that are homeless and they'll see no way out, the meaning they find is, the purpose they find is the drugs, because it takes up all their time.
Yeah.
The focus on the drug, and that's what gets them through it. And Viktor Frankl writes a lot, and it's only a short little book, and I'd recommend anybody to read it. So I'll link it in the description, but it's about finding meaning, and you know, just that gives you that resilience to get through things that you think that you may never be able to experience, you know.
Yeah, I do. I know it's kind of different, but when the lockdown came in, I went back, started training with my local triathlon club, and I'd never done 10K more than that point, right? And I used to do music and stuff before, but I joined the triathlon club, and then I started running 10Ks, and then I started running 15Ks, and then I'd go out and cycle 40K, and then I was cycling 80K, and then I was cycling 100Ks, then I was going out swimming for miles, and then in the last 7 months, I've run 2 full marathons, right? But every time I'd done something that I didn't think I'd done, it could reset the mind that I was more capable of doing than what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's where now to do the half an hour man in August has come from. Whereas if you taught me 12 months ago or 17 months ago I'd be doing this, I would have laughed at you and said, no fucking hope, you know. But it's because I achieved something and I reset the mind and said, well, that was actually wasn't that bad. Maybe I can do this. And you reset and you move on, you know.
Yeah.
So, but there is, and it's, that's the experience that we're way more capable of what we can achieve, but we're just not aware that we can do it because we set the cap on what our abilities are.
Yeah.
And maybe it's the same with people that are, you know, that are down and out and struggling, and you know, there can be a sense of that this is it, how am I going to get out of here, I have no way out of it. But Jesus, every time you're alive, you're out of it, you know what I mean, because you're one day further down the road.
That's true. No, when you're talking about the running there, somebody came to mind, you might know him, Brian O'Donovan.
I know him well, yeah.
Brian is into the long distance running and walking. So I think he's walking in South Hill, is he?
Yeah.
Brian texted me the other day. They're doing a 100K run or something for charity. He asked me to give it a plug, so there's my opportunity.
I linked
that in the description too, you know. They're doing great work above in South Hill.
Yeah, no, I know Brian well, and I get great inspiration off Brian of where he's come and what he's achieved in such a short time. I think the man is so mentally strong and focused. So I do, I admire him.
And he's a gent.
He's a gent, he's an absolute gent. He's a soft man in his presence. But I do, I know him well, and I do follow him in that sense. And it is a sense of something, he can do it, I can do it, you know.
Yeah.
And they're doing it for Limerick City Watch, you know, the Suicide Watch. That's what they're doing it for. Okay. So there's the right plug for
it. So he'd be happy with that. So well done, Brian.
Brian's the guy that done that convention, Russ, is it?
He did. He was at the convention with us. He was with Cork Alliance and that.
I was actually only texting him there yesterday.
Oh, yeah. He was getting us at all the angles, wasn't he? But back to yourself, Joe. Back to yourself. Just want to continue on. So you had a very strong work ethic and you've worked throughout. But you were using the substances, and no matter what it was just to kill the time and to help numb you in the existence you were living.
I was unhappy. I was really unhappy.
How long did that go on for?
For many years, if I'm going to be honest. Like, you know, it was a funny experience. Like, I got kicked out of school, and I deserved to be kicked out of school, you know, but I had no interest in being there. I remember going in. Actually, the only reason I got into secondary school is in the primary school, I got hit with a block in my eye and cut my eye. And I went up to do the exam for the secondary school and I didn't get in. But I went in and didn't even read the questions, blah, 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 and got kicked out. But my mother went down into the school and told the principal, if you don't get him into that school, I'm going to sue the school for cutting his eye. So I got in. So, of course, I was in, like, there was all the lowest classes in the house, and we were in with all the messers, and I'd done a couple of years of that. And I got kicked out, and I came back to do my junior cert 6 months after being kicked out, and same with then just went blah, blah, blah. They put me into a different class. I didn't even know these people, like, you know. And of course, I failed that. I went off on my TOD, and then I went into one of the education centres, and I loved it in there because I'm really good at my hands. I'm good at building, right? So I started making TV units, and I was selling them around the place. My entrepreneur thing going on, you know. And then I said, this is what I'm into. So I started to learn, actually, more intelligent than I thought I was. Academically, I struggle, but practically, I'm really good. Like, I'll build a house, right? So, and I found that they were my passions. And I'd done that for a while. And we left it in the end. Actually, they got me a job in a warehouse, and I'd done that for a while and kind of left that. But then I went back doing cleaning and stuff. So I never considered myself intelligent, you know, brain intelligent, like, you know. So I always done labour and jobs, I always done grafting jobs, and that's where I found myself comfortable in, you know. But it after a while, I went to Dell Computers and got a job there, and that actually made that was a pivotal change in my life, because I worked in there as a grafter, and they worked you like dogs in there, and there was no kind of staff morale. You'd done it or you were fired. It's all fair best, but I did my market. So I quickly went up the line from pushing the buttons to the administrator, where I had to do all the computer stuff, to line supervisor, you know. And because of doing that, I had to send emails. So I had to learn to grammar, and I had to learn to spell. And I still struggle. I have dyslexia, so I struggle with my spelling. But spell check, obviously, in the computer, but I'd still get it wrong, and I'd get words that sound the same wrong and all that kind of stuff. But it lifted me a bit that I was maybe more capable than I thought. And I went to New York for a while, and I was grafting over there, you know. But when I came back, I started volunteering for a service that worked with families affected by imprisonment, the Bedford Row Family Project. And it was a lovely synergy, because the manager of the Bedford Row at the time, Larry, when I was a kid, he was a youth worker in South Hill and used to take us fishing and camping. And I met him. I said, oh, can I come and down volunteer for you? And he said, grand. And he actually became my mentor. He took me under his wing. He put me into personal development courses. He put me onto counselling courses. He helped me with my proofreading. And that whole service of Bedford Row and the people in it, most more grassroots, and came up through the community who experienced imprisonment and got educated and worked there. So it was a really nice environment, and they're always supportive. At the time, what I was doing was wearing the shell of confidence, but I wasn't. I was totally insecure. Mm. But I hid it well, and I did and done my job. But I'm only coming off the back of a master's. And, you know, I've done loads of counselling over the years and loads of group counselling. And it was all grand, and there's loads of awareness in it. And I learned a lot about myself, right? But it was only actually after this master's, I'd go and do another 30 hours of therapy. And I always felt like a fraud that I was doing this job, but actually I was winging it, that I didn't know what I was doing. And I, even though I've been doing it for the last 12 or 13 years, I've stayed in education for the last 12 and 13 years, and I still felt like a fraud, right? Mm-hmm. That I didn't know. And sooner or later, someone's going to find out that I haven't a clue what I'm doing, you know? And it was this time though when I went to the therapy, and maybe the world's aligned. And what I realized, and this resonated with your last interview with Gabba when you asked him about yourself. What I realized is all those insecurities was the inner child that was controlling the man, right? I wasn't that person anymore. And I finally figured that out. All my insecurities, all my lack of confidence, I was still being decided by this kid who was an internal. And I figured out I was able to separate it. So this kid is no longer affecting my life or controlling my life. Yes, anxiety comes up every now and again, but that's normal. We have a sense of insecurities. But I'm good at what I do. You know what I mean? I'm really good at what I do because I've educated myself for the last 12 years in the theory of it. I spent my entire life living it.
What was the master's?
Addiction counseling psychotherapy.
And how did you find doing the master's with dyslexia? Was it tough?
It nearly broke me. And I was just saying, I done the 2 years, done all the modules, and then I had to take a year away. And I just went back now, and I'm in the middle of completing the dissertation now. Well, it was the hardest thing I ever done. And I find myself being really annoyed that this whole structured essay defines my experience and my education. And I think it's unfair because I have no interest in it. I hate having to do it, you know, because it's so difficult for me to do and doing the references and all those kind of things. But it's like, why is that the only way of presenting my intelligence in this area of what I'm doing, that I have to write this essay in this way? And if I fail this structure, I am in a way failing all the experience I have because I won't have the paperwork to show it. So that bothers me. I think there should be more flexibility on how you can present your intelligence and your education in the area you want to work with, in the expertise that you want to work in. But that was the biggest turning point in my life. And that was only in the last couple of years. If the Tommy Terran show had contacted me previously, I would never would have went on the show. No way would I have stuck my neck out like that, you know. So
I've a similar experience to yourself. The Tommy Terran show asked me to go on they asked me to come on in 2018, and I was just after finishing my bachelor's degree, and I was very I wasn't well enough in myself to do it, you know what I mean? And I just said no, you know, after meeting them. After that then, when I did my master's, and I was getting married, and I was way better in myself, do you know what I mean? Came back a year later and asked me, and I was like, you know what, the time is right now, and I feel more confident. I feel like it's very similar to yourself there, isn't it?
It's like,
you know, that the time was right. And
and it has to be the right. I said to someone the other day, this is the best version of myself I've ever been. You know, and I'm not perfect, and I have my ups and downs, but I am the best version of myself I've ever been. And it was all through the therapy, and it was all through being open and speaking about my issues. It was all through accepting who I am. I love who I am, you know, and for a long time I didn't. But I wasn't able to love who I am. I wasn't allowed the space or the time to actually really get to know myself, you know. And then I always found, and even with people that did know me, even people I grew up with, in my own parents and siblings, they didn't know me at all. They saw a version of me which they thought was me, and I spent for myself, you haven't a clue who I am. You know nothing about me. No one ever asked, you know, no one ever took the time. And even if they had, I honestly probably wouldn't have had the confidence and the feel safe enough to tell them who I am.
Or even the vocabulary to have it, to just speak about it, you know. That's where education comes into the light of it. Education is critical for someone like you or me to be able to express ourselves, you know, to gain a vocabulary, to understand the wording in terms of the feelings that we're going through, you know. And when that happens, then when we learn the words that we can express ourselves with, that's where we're able to inspire other people that are behind us to help them out, you know. So there was another point. I think it's well worth to mention as well, the Tommy Tiernan show, right? They bring on some fantastic guests like yourself, James, and other people.
And good-looking ones too, wouldn't they?
They don't keep it at a level where it's related to non-crime or anything like that. They bring really inspirational people on that are really doing fantastic things, you know, and there was a thought came to my head, and I don't know, does anybody from the Tommy Tiernan show watch it? And maybe somebody will, because the two of yourselves, a great guest that I think would be perfect for the Tommy Tiernan show, and it would be around all this stuff as well, what you're doing,
real life,
we're doing here, would be Damien Quinn, where he speaks about the Garda vetting situation and integrating people from prison, and not just prison, people that have had tough backgrounds with addiction and stuff like that and homelessness, and just to talk about it and how to integrate them back into society in terms of jobs and not just jobs. There's a very important aspect to that as well. It's about therapy. It's about getting people ready for these environments as well, you know.
I don't know, would Damien be interested? No, we had Damien on the Tuanari's podcast, so I don't know, would he take a step backwards, you know?
Yeah, very good. But on that, I was listening to your wife's podcast, and that was fantastic, right? And I think the more people that can speak, I see it in two different ways. Ye have now excelled yourselves, right? And ye have lift your status in society, right? From where you started. Ye are now people that that society find credible, right? And they listen to what you have to say. They listen to your stories, and they listen, and maybe they're listening, so they'll take it in. There's education now happening, you know? And when your wife was saying about setting the bar of getting to Limerick Prison, I understand that. I get that, you know? But I think the rest of society will now get that and listen, because they're listening to people that they believe, right? Mm. Sadly, a lot of people that are still kind of living in disadvantage or living in areas that are considered rough or considered no-go areas, they have all this experience, right, and all this advice, but they have no credibility because society won't give it to them because they see them less than, right? Mm. And I think this is why this is so important, that you have people who have the experience, in-depth knowledge and experience, but now are at a level, and it's sad that they have that level where society will find them, will listen, you know. But this is what this is about. Yeah. This is what this is doing.
It's like what Tommy Tiernan gave me and you a platform, you know, and now we're using that bit of status that I am anyway, that bit of a profile that I got to get people on the podcast.
Yeah.
And because when I come off the Tommy Tiernan show, so many people contacted me and I never felt like I'm nothing special or anything like that. And I know a lot of people like me that have equal good stories, you know what I mean? Likes of Timmy, the likes of yourself, the guests we've had on. And I was like, you know what? I want to give these people a platform because there's so much wisdom, experience out there.
Yeah.
And they should be, you know, I value all that. You know, so that's the beauty of having an independent production, you know what I mean? Is that
pick and choose?
Yeah, exactly.
And it'll grow like this grew from the Tommy Tiernan show. Other people, it'll just keep growing. Other people have the confidence to go away and do their own thing and start their own podcasts or their own whatever it may be. Do you know?
It's the nitty gritty and it's the honesty. And this is why I think, for me personally, why I follow you and why I think it's so good is, It's the topic, it's a difficult topic, but it's a topic that needs to be shared, and it's a topic that will have great learning for other people that maybe will change their perspective and change the bias that they have and the bias they're unaware that they have, you know. I do a lot of kind of trying to get people to think of, I was at a comedy club, right, with Reginald D. Hunter. He's a southern black, southern guy, and down in Galway. And he kept saying through the comedy show, which wasn't relevant to the comedy show, beware of your bias, they may not be yours. Because what they are is they were given to you through your family or people of influence. And now, racism, this is where it comes from, right? Yeah. You weren't born a racist, you become a racist. Yeah. But you can get to a stage in your life where you think, do you know what? Do I actually believe that? Is that mine? Is that my true believing, or someone give me that? Mm. Do I still believe that? Do I want to believe that? And this is where you can challenge your bias, because the bias was given to you by someone else, and you don't have to keep that. Mm. You can change your opinion on someone. Your family mightn't, or your peers mightn't, but you have the right to change your views. And this is how it will be done. It'll be done through education, and it'll be done through people speaking with a level of passion and credibility. Sadly, it's needed. You need credibility, you know.
I think you're touching on an important point there, and it's around people can change their opinions and biases and become aware. That's why I have a big problem with cancel culture, you know. If somebody said something years ago and it's brought to light today, that's the end of them. And you see it happening all the time. Yeah, yeah. And I often said to my wife, you know, if stuff came up from my past or Timmy's past or all of our pasts that we were judged on today, it'd be cancelled in the morning. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But people have the capacity to learn. People have the capacity to change, become aware, become more wise and mature, you know. So I think, like, cancelling people and, you know, writing them off, you know, they should be allowed to...
I mean, if you don't allow to change, then what's the point in sending someone to prison? Well, the whole purpose of prison, it's supposed to be, you know, if it doesn't work that way, was to rehabilitate.
Mm.
Okay, so now they've come out of prison, they've changed, but you're still judging them on what they've done in their past, you know?
Yeah.
One of the best things I ever heard, I follow Muhammad Ali, right? I think he's a legend. I think he's a very wise man.
Mm.
But he said something that always resonated with me. If you act an age at 60 the same way you did at 30, you've wasted 30 years of your life.
Mm.
Life is all about growing. But you can only grow if your eyes are open and you have and you're able to grow and you expand your view. So if you, like, take parenting even, right? And this is the generational stuff. So my father parented me how he was parented, and it was with an iron fist. But that's what he knew. He knew no better, right? I know that now.
Mm.
But at the time, you know. But if he... No, they didn't at that time, but just say it was in this time and we were there again and he was made go to a parenting course. Of course, or he may go to different things where he can expand his view, expand that tunnel vision, say, oh, actually, there's other ways of rearing children, and maybe the way my parents done it for me wasn't the best in the first place. Then you've learned. But you can only do that if you expand outside your bubble. So if you stay with the same people, with the same conversations, you will never learn anything new.
Yeah.
You have to expand it out, you know? And that's where, like, the key workers and, you know, the youth workers, and they integrate themselves into society or into a closed society in some ways, and try and expand people's horizons and grow. Like,
it's true, it's true. Yeah. Do you want to talk to us about equine therapy?
Yeah. So the equine therapy, like I said, you know, we had horses when we were younger in South Hill. And that's where I went to express all my emotions because I had nowhere else to do it. So I'd done it on the horses and the donkey at the time. And the donkey was, for a long time, people laughed at me, but he was my best friend.
Do you know when you're living in a council estate and you have horses and donkeys?
Yeah.
Are they in the garden?
Yeah. Yeah. And then they're in the back garden. But it was funny, like I said, South Hill at the time, you were at one side, it was all the countryside, right? And it was like the Wild West. And what everyone done was, there was a golf course there now, but before it was all open land. And people just went and fenced off their part. This is my part. That's your part. You are. Keep your horses out of my land. It's not your land. It's my land, right? So all this went on. But there'd be killings, right? And then if someone put the horse in, you'd kick it out and say, a fucking pound, I'll take that horse. You don't put him into my land again, you know? So this happened. But then the golf course came and it took all the land away, right? So, but I don't know what the county council thought, that people would just stop having horses, but it just forced them right into the middle of the council. So we had them there and we had them in the back garden. We had them everywhere, really. But yeah, so I'd go to the horses and I'd get my needs met, my emotional needs met. And so I always knew that they would do something, right? But of course, it wasn't until I was an adult and became educated in an area of counselling and reflective practice that I really started seeing what they were giving me and what they were giving me as emotional release. And then maybe that's why I didn't go that far into the drug use. So I had a release, you know, I had something that I go to. And so then we fast forward on and I trained I worked with families in the Bedford Row, working with families affected by imprisonment. And I spent 3 years, and that's where I volunteered and started training. And I worked with the youths and I worked with one or two families from different areas. And then I trained as an addiction counsellor and I started working as an addiction counsellor with adolescents. Spent 8 years working with drug using adolescents in the service in Limerick and to cover the Midwest. But it was during that time, early in that time, one of the other workers said, oh, there's some kind of demo with horses out in the deer. Do you want to go? And I said, of course, horses, off we go. And I went out and watched them. It's called the EGAL model, which is the Equine Assisted Growth and Learning Association. And what it is equine assisted counselling, right? So this is the difference. So there's equine assisted therapies and equine assisted riding for disabilities and all that kind of stuff. But what I do is equine assisted counselling. So what I'm doing is counselling through the intermedium of horses. And why I loved it so much was there's an ethical side behind it. So there's a team approach. So you have to have a trained mental health professional. So as from Irish perspective, you have to have a counsellor or psychotherapist as part of the team. You also have to have an equine specialist. So it's someone who's trained in horses with many years experience in the horses. So the way it works is very simply, it's ground-based activities. The horses are totally unrestrained in their natural environment, right? And the reason you use horses is... through years of evolution as a prey animal, as in they were hunted and ate. That's what they'd done. You know, they weren't hunters. They learned really internal skills and really powerful skills on scanning the area, right? They know what's coming. They know when a sleeping lion is asleep or pretending to be asleep. They know when his belly's full, right? So they have these internal skills that they never lost. So even though they became domesticated, they keep those heightened sense of their scanning their environment. They can pick up a human heartbeat from around 4 feet away, right? So what makes them so effective in this role is if you have someone who's going into their environment and have the poker face on, you know, I'm grand, but on the inside they're in turmoil. The horse can see that difference because they're really, obviously they've no language, but they're really strong on body language. That's how they communicate. So they'll pick up on everything you're doing, your presence, how you're standing, how you're breathing, how your heart rate is. And then if there's insight, I don't know, anguish going on, they seem to be able to read it. It's really in-depth, right? So what will happen then is based on how you're behaving, the horse will respond to you, whether he can trust you or not. So what the what's happening for the person then is they're in there with the horses. The horses are behaving in whatever manner, but it's triggering something in you, right? My job then, and the equine specialist's job, is to figure out what's going on here. So, oh, that one is making me nervous, right? Mm. So what is it about the horse that's making you nervous? Right. Well, I don't know. You know, if you're working with adolescents, they usually won't answer that question. But it's not a talking therapy. You don't have to. But when you're working with adults, you usually get a bit more. They're a bit more communicative.
Yeah.
I don't know. So what I would say, you know, okay, has been other times in your life where you feel this kind of level of nervousness. So what I'm doing is taking it away from the horses and bringing it back into their life. And the way it goes on, then the horses turn into real life representations of areas of their life. The arena and the horses turn into people and places.
Mm.
Well, that one's like my mother. Because they very much have personalities. They're very much a community pack. You'll have the head of the pack. You'll have the submissive one. You'll have the one that doesn't know boundaries. You'll have the one that's slobbing around the place. But they all mean something. So very quickly, yeah, that one's my boss or that one's my mother. So yeah. We're no longer dealing with horses. Now we're dealing with your mother, right? Mm-hmm. And your mother has just done something to this other thing. So what's that? What's going on with your mother there? And that's how the language I would use. And then what they do is start seeing their mother. Like a simple example is we had a mother come down with a daughter who was 18 and the mother wanted the daughter to go to college. The daughter didn't want to go. And we were in the arena and then we were working through this. And one of the big horses and small horses, and the big horse, for lack of a better word, bit the smaller horse in the arse, right, and pushed it through a fence, right? And the mother was watching this and she goes, that's what I'm doing to my daughter, isn't it? I'm pushing her away from me. I was like, I don't know, is that what's happening? You know, so she saw herself, she saw her daughter. So the horses give her a real life visual role play of situations. And that's what I do.
That's unbelievable, isn't
it? Yeah,
yeah.
So that's why I work with behavioural and emotional issues. And if you're in the counselling room with me, right, it can be an intense environment. It's also a very intimate environment, right? And for some people it works really well. But for others, they don't want to go and do that, right? They don't want talking therapy. When you're with the horses, the visual is external. I'm not looking at you. When we're looking, we're all looking at the horses. So we're looking at the horses. We're talking about the horses. What's going on for the horses? I won't be asking you what's going on for you while you're looking at them. I'm saying, what's going on with the horses? How do you think they're behaving? How do you think they're feeling? But I'm not giving any indication to you how I think they're feeling. So it's all coming from you. It's like a mirror effect.
Mm.
They're projecting the whole lot on. And then when they're projecting, then you can start getting into deeper parts of their life. And then you might say, you know, I've disconnected, like, okay, well, I welcome you to go and connect with your mother if abandonment is the issue. Like.
Yeah.
So you can pick a topic that they want to work on, right? But sometimes they'll come in and say, I don't know what I want to work on. So there's no agenda because you can't set an agenda because I don't know how the horse is going to behave to you and I don't know what's going to bring up you. So it's totally experiential and totally in the moment. So whatever you say is the focus of our conversation.
Yeah.
So which means it empowers you when you have to take the lead. Now, when it's happening, myself and my colleague will be standing at the far end of the arena. We're not with you. We've moved away and you're out there doing what you need to do. And sometimes they're out there and they're lost. So, okay, well, you're lost. That's the process. That's what you're feeling, or you're feeling lost. If I come in and tell you what to do, I've disempowered you. Mm-hmm. The whole point is to create a safe environment where you can practice real life situations in a safe place where the horses can be like humans. And you need to figure it out. If you're lost, I can't save you in there. You have to figure it out.
You know, it sounds like it would be very helpful, you know, for people that want or need therapy or counselling, but maybe they're not able to or willing to have a kind of level of introspection or share some of their innermost thoughts with somebody else because of trust. Having that external thing to focus on could help bring that out in a way. Like, all the focus is not on me. The focus is on the horse, but that brings that out, you know. I think it would really help people.
Do you take
referrals from the HSE? Is it private? Can people do pay?
So I get referrals from many different areas. Obviously, the more platforms I do, the busier I get. But for a long time, I would have got referrals from the HSE, and usually kids that end up in foster care when they didn't want to go there. You're not going to waste them or take it from the family. I do a lot of work with Garda Diversion, that kind of stuff. So I have a program. Like, so there's two levels. So I do equine assisted counselling. And that is that kind of deeper therapeutic stuff. But then I'd have groups, and that would be equine assisted learning, because you're not going to do a deep therapy with someone that's going to be exposed in a group and make them vulnerable. So I run a program called the Power Tools for Living, and that's very directive. And we work on communication skills, boundaries, relationships, respect, choices and consequences, all that kind of stuff. And they work through it. And we had one of the drug services down. And we were doing a thing around boundaries. Mm. So, and they're in recovery and they're doing well. And it was about how to protect your boundaries when you get out into the real world again, you know. So I got them to build, because of props and things. So I built something that will represent your boundaries, right? Mm. And what I done then was got a load of horse feed and threw it into the middle of it. And they had to stop the horses from coming inside their boundaries, but they couldn't touch the horses, right? So they had to figure out how they're going to protect their boundaries from these horses. But so they built this big elaborate thing, right? And it was all walls and barrels, and they put a lot of time in. We watched, it's just really cool. But the horses got in, destroyed it all, right? Knocked everything to the ground. And a different learning happened than I expected. One of them said, Jesus, that's like my mother's house when we destroy it from parties. Mm-hmm. Right? And he's sitting down, he's looking at the place destroyed that he just built. And he looked at, and he became the horse and the representation, give me family's home. And he was starting to empathize what his mother must felt like when he destroyed the house. And then the rest of the lads started talking about this. So I just, this is great learning. We'll just go with this, you know. So this is what happened through the horse's behavior, you know, totally off the direction that I wanted to go, because it was about peer pressure I wanted to look at. But this is what happens. So this is great learning. So we done that, you know. Mm-hmm. We had another lad, same thing, actually from one of the services. And I have a horse there who's quite sensitive. And if you're not very calm and very relaxed, you can't get anywhere near her, right? She won't have you. But she's beautiful, so they all want to be around her. So this lad was trying to catch this horse. And we were watching him in the distance. But he was really, really, everything was fast and everything was aggressive and everything was anger, you know. He kept trying to get her. And she would just move 2 feet away from him every time out of his reach. And next he said, that horse is a stuck-up. You know, he leapt, right? And he stormed out of the arena. And the lads were laughing at him. Said, no, let him go. So he went off up anyway, and he calmed down and he came back in. So right, let's talk about this. Like, you know, so what happened? Oh, that horse is a stuck up, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Is there anything else that might be going on for the horse? You know, is there any other feelings the horse might be going through? And then, of course, his peers were like, because they're used to therapy now at this stage. Yeah. Maybe he's shy. Or maybe you're frightening the horse, or maybe the horse is nervous, right? So we started talking about all these other ways. So is there something around your approach that's frightening the horse? And then, of course, I dropped in as the mental health person. I said, I wonder, has been other times in your life where you thought people were stuck up, blah, 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 but really they were insecure and they were shy and maybe they were a bit afraid of you. And next you could see, boom, 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 right? So if I had said this at the start, they would have just got defensive. Mm. No, I'm not like that, you know? So you don't, because we push back all the time, as Gav was with this thing, you know. So you don't, you let it happen organically through the horses. And because it's done through the horses, there's no need to feel intimidated or defensive, because you've just experienced it naturally through yourself. So that's an example of visuals of how being with the horses will say, oh, that's what it means.
Mm. It's a bit of like motivational interviewing as well, where like you get them to see the value, you get them to experience the change themselves. Yeah. Or maybe if you're working with somebody, you're not going to tell them how to behave or how to best change. Yeah. You help them, you facilitate them, so they come to that.
It's promoting autonomy. I'm a member of MINT, the Motivational Interviewing Network of Trainers. So I've trained in MI since the very start. I love it. Yeah. I love the ethos around it. I love the respect that it gives to the person that you're working with. And I love the honesty that says, you're the expert. And I truly believe that. Even when the work that we're doing with the horses, trust me, what I do is, you're the expert on you. And you just need to figure it out, you know. So it's all you're trying to do is you're drawing out all this stuff so they can figure it out for themselves. So my whole approach is motivational interview.
You know, that's what I was going to say, is the approach you have to that situation. Say, for instance, that young lad you were on the boat there, and his demeanour was probably very angry and all these different things. But if you went into a session with him and you said something like that, he would get very offensive.
Of course he would.
You know, and I'm looking at this now from my own kind of experience, because I would have been very... But when you look at a horse and it's an actual situation, an experience, and there's nobody labelling you, we're looking at a situation and you're explaining a possibility, it's a very, very, very easier way and more calmer. Mm-hmm. And for instance, he'll remember that a lot more than he will you saying, oh, you're very, you're
doing it
wrong.
He learned you know, it himself.
That's a it's a great way to actually teach young teenagers, really, about all these things.
But I try and do it in my life with my own kids. I mean, one of the things they'll always hear me saying is, when we can't do it, figure it out. Because sometimes they're just, they want you to do it because they don't want to do it. But mm-hmm. Well, figure it out. You know, just figure it out. You know, especially when I know it's not something that's a risk to them. Because I want them strong, I want them independent, I want them resilient. So I'm not doing it for you. And of course, they think I'm the worst dad in the world, you know. So I'm not here to be your best friend. I'm here to teach you morals. I'm here to teach you to be a good person. Mm. And I'm here to teach you to be resilient. Yeah. And that means I can't be your best friend. You know, I'm your educator, you know.
Yeah.
And how you educate is letting them figure it out. Mm. You
know? Is there any similar service in Cork or around the country? Or?
Yeah, so the Gala model, like I said, it's worldwide. It's practiced in 50 countries. So I'm the network coordinator for Ireland. And there's a number of us around the country. There's two here in Cork. There's one in Wexford. There's one in Kildare. There's one in Limerick. There's one in Galway. I hope I'm not missing any. So there's a few around the place. And we meet regularly and we share information and we train each other. And then I would get a lot of resources and I would send it in. Like, I got loads of referrals off the Tommy Dernan Show from Cork, from different areas, but I won't take them. Morally, it would be wrong to say, yeah, come up to me when I know there's a service closer. You know, because if someone's driving, we'll say, from Dublin or Cork to see me, that's 3 hours driving up and down, right? Yeah. An hour and a half each way, an hour a session. That's 4 hours of the day gone to bring someone to get help. And that causes stress.
Yeah.
So I will never take someone that's...
At the core of what you're doing is person-centered, you know what I mean? And that's not person-centered, you know? That wouldn't sit with you.
No.
But I think we get a lot of interest once we air this podcast from people.
Yeah, yeah.
So have you got a website?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so JS Equine Therapies. You'll find it there, just put in Joe Slattery, you know.
Yeah.
Even put up, if people really want to understand it, put up the link for the TED Talk. That really explains it in great detail.
Like I linked the whole lot of them. I linked the Tommy Tiernan, the TED Talk, and I linked the website, your social media.
Yeah.
And is there a national website for the different equine counselling therapies around Ireland?
No, like if you go on to the main Egala website, which is an American-based, egala.org, www.egala.org, and go and find the program, but in Ireland, and we'll come up there, like, just all the Irish ones are on it there. Like,
yeah,
you know?
I linked that as well. What's the plans for the future? Let you finish your dissertation, I suppose, anyway.
Get that out of the way. It's I never talked about it. I run a service in Limerick as well. I run a charity for families affected by imprisonment. So I work full-time running the charity.
What's the name of the charity?
It's the North Star Family Support Project in Limerick City. So it's a free service for families affected by substance misuse. So I've gone the other side from working with the drug users, not to work with the families. Because, you see the other side of it.
Yeah.
So, and I took over that role about 2 years ago. I have a lot of plans and aspirations for that. I mean, the idea is to do the equine full time, you know, but it's not there yet. You know, there's other services in America and they're employing loads of people and that's what they do full time. Ireland is a bit slower with alternatives and looking at alternatives to traditional talk therapy. But the plan is at some stage to have my own therapeutic facility that will do the equine therapy, that will incorporate mindfulness, will incorporate workshops, but all that nature based, you know. Now, obviously, I'm not a rich person. Even the land I use at the moment is not mine. It's a neighbor who's letting me use it. So it's a long way down the road. Maybe it's more a goal and aspiration to get there, have my property, have those facilities and do that full time, you know. But right now it's to balance the lot. So obviously I do all my training and my sports. I'm running the charity. I'm in the middle of doing my master's and I do the equine therapy. So.
You've a lot going on.
I have.
But you've got big plans.
I have big plans, but what I've done is I've learned to balance them because I burnt out in the past, you know, and it was a bad burnout and it was great learning in it. So I now, I'm also older. I don't have the energy I used to have to do all that stuff and hold all that anymore, like, you know. So now what I've learned to do, whereas in the past, because of the work ethic, I would never say no to work. Any kind of work. So I could be doing 5 different things at one time and just grafting. No, I just said no. I said no, I'm not, sorry, I can't do it. I don't have time, you know, I just mind myself. And I keep that balance of pleasure because I know once that starts going, that means my mental health is not well if I start dropping the stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm not doing that anymore, I just said no.
Yeah, well, you're doing a phenomenal work there. If there's any way we can ever help, you know, in terms of, I don't know, a fundraiser or something like that, I don't know, we'd be very happy to help out.
Well, actually,
if you're ever looking to break in any horses, give me a shout. I have a brother there, he's a great old jockey.
We don't do any horse riding, it's all young best.
Yeah.
So I don't even ride anymore. I used to, I don't ride anymore. But you are, like, I mean, you are doing great work, and there's a lot of notoriety around you now, and you're very well respected. So you are in demand, you know. There is talk to try and get you to Limerick to do something up there, maybe in September for the recovery week, you know. So
that'll be the job. We're actually in County Clare in October, in the Stone Varna.
On the road.
50 tickets. If it opens up, we'll get 100 in there.
Yeah, brilliant.
No, I think there's about 40 tickets sold already, but half Knock Naheeny is going to be...
Yeah,
this Dunverna, what now I had it, this Dunverna, Le Hinch Doolin, all them B&Bs are all getting booked at the moment.
But there's great interest in the top of addiction, and it's growing all the time, and there's great awareness. And I suppose one of my theories around it is because drugs are now, you know, whereas in the past they weren't as sociable as they are now, whereas obviously cocaine and cannabis is very sociable and very much accepted within the country, which is causing a lot of damage, which means a lot of people are being affected by it, but so is their families and so is their friends. So a lot of people now are more interested in the topic because they have some kind of either first hand experience or second hand experience, and now they want to learn about it. So sadly, because of what's happening, it's becoming more notoriety around it. But on the flip side, then, you have a lot of people wanting to know more about it and be educated in it because they're kind of affected in one way or another.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you'll fill them. You should fill them. I mean, I think anyone, when you do drug kind of education, all those courses now are filling up.
Yeah.
Sadly, for the wrong reason, but they're filling up, you know.
Yeah. But look, we'll call it a day. Thanks a million for coming down to meet us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It was a real pleasure talking to you. Very interesting stuff through the whole way through. Yeah,
definitely. Definitely believe what you're doing is something that's fantastic, because I could picture myself in some of the situations there, and it would be a great way for people to understand themselves and for information to be given to them on a really relaxed kind of level instead of another authority figure telling them, oh, that's wrong with you, you know. So I think something like that and explaining it to them and the background to it is fantastic.
Yeah, we do demos all the time, free demos for services for people, because it's hard to explain until you experience it. And when you experience it, then a lot of people have profound impacts only in a demo. And that's why you need a mental health person, because you don't know what it triggers in people, like, you know.
Excellent. Fair play, Joe. Stay in touch. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Timmy. Thanks, Rowan.
And
we'll see. Thanks, George. Safe journey home. Enjoy the big smoke. And we'll see everybody next week.
Hi everybody, thanks for listening to the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and don't forget to head over to the Patreon if you'd like to help us. Thanks again.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.